Memphis, 1939. The shantyboat Arcadia rocks gently on the Mississippi River, home to 12-year-old Rill Foss and her four younger siblings. Their world is small but magical, filled with their father Briny's fantastical stories, their mother Queenie's quiet strength, and the freedom of river life. When Queenie goes into labor with twins and complications arise, Briny rushes her to the hospital, leaving Rill in charge. "We'll be back before you know it," he promises. But some promises can't be kept. Within hours, strangers claiming to be police officers arrive, forcing the children into a black automobile that carries them away from everything they've ever known. "Just until your mama gets well," they're told. Another broken promise in a story about to overflow with them. The Tennessee Children's Home Society isn't a home at all. It's a processing center where poor children are transformed into valuable commodities under the watchful eye of Georgia Tan. Here, Rill becomes May, her siblings are renamed, and their identities systematically erased. "Smile pretty for the nice people," Miss Tan instructs, as wealthy couples browse for children like shoppers at a department store. The blonde ones fetch the highest prices. The darker ones are harder to place. Those who resist are beaten, starved, or worse. What makes this nightmare all the more chilling? It really happened. Between 1924 and 1950, Georgia Tan and her network of corrupt officials, doctors, and social workers kidnapped an estimated 5,000 children, primarily from poor families, and sold them to wealthy adoptive parents. The operation was conducted openly, with Tan celebrated as a children's advocate while she amassed a fortune through her adoption fees. Meanwhile, countless birth parents searched desperately for children who had simply vanished. How do children survive such trauma? For Rill and her siblings, the answer varies painfully. Some adapt, some rebel, some disappear entirely. When Camelia, the fierce second eldest, vanishes after being punished, something breaks in Rill. "There is no Camelia," she begins to say, the first of many self-protective lies. When she and Fern are eventually adopted by the wealthy Sevier family, Rill faces an impossible choice: embrace comfort and safety at the cost of her true identity, or cling to memories that grow more painful by the day. The psychological toll is devastating. Even acts of kindness become suspect. When Mr. Sevier offers piano lessons, Rill waits for the hidden cost. When Mrs. Sevier brushes her hair gently, she wonders what will be demanded in return. Haven't we all, at some point, questioned whether love comes with invisible strings attached? For children like Rill, that question isn't philosophical, it's a survival mechanism. Fast forward to present-day South Carolina, where federal prosecutor Avery Stafford has returned home to support her father, a prominent senator battling cancer. Her life runs on rails of privilege and expectation: the perfect fiancé, the perfect career, the perfect political pedigree. But during a nursing home visit, an elderly resident named May Crandall grabs Avery's vintage dragonfly bracelet and calls her by a stranger's name. "You're Fern's girl," she insists, setting Avery on a collision course with her family's carefully buried secrets. What if the foundations of your identity were built on quicksand? Avery begins pulling threads that unravel a tapestry of family mythology, the photograph in May's room showing a woman who looks eerily like Avery's grandmother, the mysterious riverside property her grandmother still owns but never visits, the way her grandmother sometimes calls her by unfamiliar names in moments of dementia-induced clarity. Haven't we all sensed those family silences, topics that cause the room to still, conversations that halt when children enter? Avery discovers that these silences often protect the most essential truths. As Avery's investigation deepens, she meets Trent Turner, whose grandfather dedicated his life to reuniting families torn apart by the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Together, they uncover the shocking truth: Avery's grandmother Judy, the refined matriarch of the Stafford political dynasty, was born Rill Foss on a shantyboat. May Crandall is her long-lost sister. For decades, these sisters maintained a secret relationship, meeting privately while publicly pretending to be casual acquaintances. The river becomes more than setting. It's a metaphor for how the past continues flowing into the present. The water remembers, May tells Avery, even when we forget. Isn't that true of all trauma? The body remembers what the mind tries to forget. The river of genetic memory carries forward what conscious thought attempts to dam. When Avery finally brings May to visit her sister in the nursing home, Judy no longer recognizes her. Yet something deeper than memory responds. Her hand reaches for May's, fingers intertwining with the instinctive recognition that transcends cognitive understanding. The novel's emotional core isn't just about family separation. It's about the unbreakable bonds between sisters. The Foss girls create secret languages, share meaningful glances, and hold on to their true names in whispered conversations. Years later, the surviving sisters establish Sisters' Day, an annual gathering where they briefly return to being Foss sisters again, sharing stories and laughter away from the lives they've built. These relationships aren't idealized. The sisters fail each other in profound ways. Rill carries devastating guilt for decades about leaving Camellia behind and for ultimately bringing Fern back to the Seviers rather than continuing their escape attempt. Yet their connection endures. We're sisters, May tells Avery. That's a bond that nothing can break. This resonates universally. Think about your own siblings or closest friends, how you can fight fiercely yet defend each other instantly against outside threats, how you share references and jokes no one else understands, how you sometimes communicate more in silence than others do in lengthy conversations. These connections form our emotional bedrock, especially in times of crisis. What defines family? The novel explores this question through May's evolution from captive to genuine member of the Sevier family. You need not be born into a family to be loved by one, she acknowledges. This doesn't erase her trauma, but shows how healing can occur within new family structures. Avery's discovery of her grandmother's origins adds layers to her identity, rather than diminishing it. We're not just one thing or another, May explains. We're many things at once, our parents and our children, our past and our future. The story concludes with brave choices. Avery arranges a reunion between the elderly sisters despite political risks and removes her engagement ring, choosing authenticity. May returns to her riverside cottage, surrounded by memories of lost sisters while reconnected with her surviving one. The ending's power lies in its honesty. Georgia Tan escaped justice. Many families remained separated and trauma persisted. Yet characters find ways to reclaim agency and create meaning, not by erasing wounds, but by acknowledging them while moving forward with their complete histories.